2004 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 334, Making Saints and Soldiers, with panelists from the creators of the film.
Jeffrey Panos. Jeffrey wrote the original film story and co-wrote the screenplay for Saints and Soldiers with Matt Whitaker. This is his first screenplay. Jeffrey based much of his Saints and Soldiers on real-life combat experience that he gleaned from interviews with World War II veterans across the U.S. and overseas. He's a military veteran. He's worked as a magazine and newspaper correspondent and a political media advisor. And he is currently finishing a 3-volume history of the U.S. Army Rangers in World War II. Matt Whitaker, other screenwriter, is a documentary filmmaker. He's been using the rest of his days that he's not doing documentaries to pursue his passion of screenwriting. He has produced and directed a number of documentaries, including Ancestors, a 13-part series for PBS, and Saints at War, which inspired the screenplay for Saints and Soldiers. In 2002, he produced and directed Truth and Conviction, the Helmut Huebner story, which he is currently adapting into a feature screenplay. What we thought we'd do is start off by just showing the trailer to the film, and then starting with Jeffrey and then Matt, they're going to talk a little bit about their experience coming into this project, how they adapted some of these stories of Latter-day Saints and World War II into a screenplay, and they'll just each speak briefly, and then we'd be happy to take any questions, and they're happy to answer anything about the making of the film. So we'll start off with the trailer. Before I introduce Jeffrey, just a little bit about the film. Saints and Soldiers was produced entirely here in Utah during the winter of 2003, and made the film festival circuit for just under a year and won 14 Best Picture Awards around the country at different film festivals. And then it just debuted in theaters last Friday, not yesterday, but the Friday before, August 6th, and just set the record for the biggest opening week box office for any locally produced film. So we're excited to have a couple of the filmmakers here with us, and we'll have Jeffrey Panos.
Hey, absolutely nothing prepared, but I know this film so well, and what we've done, we've talked about it for 2 years now. I grew up in Salt Lake City. I come from a very prominent Jewish family and a very prominent and a reasonably strong LDS family. And that's my mother's side. And the other side, Greek Orthodox and Mormonism. So I have an interesting confluence of faith that I've experienced growing up here in Salt Lake City. I am a military historian, and I did this as a matter of avocation rather than vocation. And I was asked to write this film by the guy who worked on the film, a guy named Ray Meldrum, who is a fellow who makes all sorts of things for the movies, for war movies in particular. He's worked on Private Ryan and all that. And we collaborated for a long time on helping his things be authentic. And so when he approached me, he knew a guy named Ryan Little, who I knew his work. And Ryan Little had won, what was the awards he's won? A student Emmy and all sorts of magnificent awards just for this little student film he did at BYU called The Last Good War. I was very impressed with this as a military historian. And so I was asked to write the story. We actually met, just to let you know how these exotic things take place. I was talked to Ryan on the phone. He says, would you be interested in writing this script story? It's not really a script. A story is the actual story, you know, and the script is what you use to make the movie. It's a very different animal. And I didn't pretend to know what I was doing writing a script, so I came up with a story, and everybody had contributions as what we should put into it. And of course, one of the main parts of this is how we should portray it as a Mormon character, how strong this character should be. So I was asked to write this, and it took me about 4.5 months, and I wrote it like a novel. And I would send a chapter here and a chapter there, and let my mind rest. And after about 4.5 months, it was all in the director's hands. And then it went to a wonderful writer who I just think walks on water, Matt Whitaker here, who then transformed this into a motion picture script and story. And I was asked to purposely write it over the top, because what I was writing was a starting point. And so in this film, I wrote I think we called him Oakley. It was his Oaks, something like that.
By the time I got it, I'm not even sure that name was.
Yeah. And you have names, and you have all sorts of ideas of what a guy looks like, and you come up with core characters, and you try to introduce conflict. In case you want to know, no story can exist without some kind of conflict. And then you come to a conflict, and then you make a decision, and you go through that decision, and you have more conflicts as you try to carry out your decision. That's essentially it. Okay. So I wrote this, and the character I remember, he was a... I made him a little bit too superhero, I think, at first, and I wanted, what I wanted to do, because I am not an active LDS person. I grew up in Salt Lake City. I grew up going to the LDS church. But I wanted to, my goal was to show a character as a Mormon, as a real grown-up. Not somebody two-dimensional that's always happy and always has a good answer and always has a good attitude. And not a person who somehow, some way endures and it's all happy on the other side. I wanted to show Mormons, this character, as someone deeply flawed, deeply vulnerable, and without all the answers. I wanted to show the world that Mormon people are real, live mortals. And so I set out to do that. And we introduced some other characters that he was in conflict with, a Jewish fellow and an atheist fellow, and et cetera, et cetera. And so at that point, I got this done, and it was very elaborate and had lots and lots of characters in it. It had lots of huge battle scenes that couldn't possibly have been shot on our budget. And thank you. Hey, I never heard that. See, this is one of the funny things. In this world of motion pictures, you think that there's studios and secretaries and people moving scenery and people going to lunch at the Brown Derby and, you know, all those kind of things. Doesn't happen. I sat in an apartment and did my story. What I said to Matt, we never met. We never met until like the third day of shooting. This is how it's done. So I went to Matt, and he performed his magic. Okay? And there was still conflict and talk about how we should make this one LDS character. The producers who funded the movie, they were faithful LDS. And they wanted, at first we wrote it because they wanted this heavily identifiable character. And I think it survived when Matt was doing it. And then finally when we got into the shooting, it all changed radically. And so you never know what's you're going to show up on the set. But we still wanted to give the pheromones out of, you know, LDS signals and what this guy was like. And so at that point, I think I should hand it over to Matt for a little bit, because I think I can talk more about the technical aspects of the film and the decisions we had to make, because I was very fortunate. I was brought in to train the actors. I was on the set every day. I was there during the conflicts of how we should describe this film, whether it should be an LDS film, whether it should not, whatever that means. And because of my multicultural background, I felt I had a lot to say there. But I think it should go now to Matt for a little while, and I can come back, Matt, and he can tell you exactly how Saints and Soldiers was really written after I handed him War and Peace.
Okay, just very briefly, I'll just give a little bit of background, I guess, about myself. Raised in California, BYU graduate through their film program, as was mentioned. My day job has been, and for the moment continues to be, documentary filmmaking, although I have done a number of, LDS seminary films and missionary commercials and stuff like that. You go up to Temple Square and you'll see some of my work, which at times makes me cringe and sometimes I think it's great. But I've been screenwriting for a number of years, and when I did the documentary Saints at War, I was approached by two BYU professors who were, you may be familiar with this, but were putting together a rather large archive of interviewing LDS veterans of, it started with World War II, interviewing LDS veterans of World War II, and then it has since, you know, gone to, you know, all the other conflicts and wars since then, although there is a little bit from World War One, members of that are rare, obviously. So anyway, they approached me about doing a documentary film about these LDS veterans of World War II. We did that. It was called Saints at War. It was an incredible experience for me to interview these incredible men on both sides of the conflict. LDS American, LDS German fighting. We were trying to get even broader than that, because there were LDS veterans who fought, you know, from Australia and obviously from Great Britain, from Canada. But mainly what we were able to get in the end for budget constraints was American and German. But from that experience, really opened my eyes, first of all, to both sides of the conflict. You know, and yes, in my opinion, it was. Ryan calls it the last good war. The director calls it the last good war. But it was a war where there was, you know, there was a good guy and a bad guy at one level. But when you get down to the fighting ranks, you know, as we all know, it was a much different story. One thing I'll show very quickly. I asked every LDS veteran of World War II that I interviewed, I asked them all one question. And that was, when you were fighting, did you ever worry that you were going to shoot a brother? You're going to shoot somebody that was a member of your, you know, member of the church. And without exception, every American that I asked that question to said basically, I didn't, I couldn't worry about that. They were shooting at me, I was shooting back. One of the Germans that I asked that question to said, every single day I worried about that. I always worried I could be shooting a brother. You know, and then he said, so sometimes I would shoot, but I wouldn't aim so well. He said, maybe I was the reason we lost the war. You know, and then he started to laugh. But anyway, this whole experience really was a learning experience for me, an eye opener. So when I heard that Ryan Little and Adam were working on doing a war movie, and there were some aspects of, you know, maybe an LDS character in it, and that they had a script, I was excited, you know, to see how that was going. And then even more excited when Ryan came to me and said, you know, we've got a script, I'm going to see if you can take it and work with it. And I have, you know, he had some ideas. And so from my perspective, it was actually in November of 2002 when Ryan came to me and said, we've got the money, can we hire you to do a rewrite and do another draft of this? And I was leaving town on the 6th of December. Basically, what it came down to is I had about a week to do the script. And I said, I don't think I can get it done in time. And he said, well, if you don't, then I'm going to have to get somebody else to do it. And I said, oh, okay, all right. So I wrote straight basically 24 hours a day, it felt like, for about 8 days, and handed in a draft to Ryan. And from a writer's point of view, a screenwriter's point of view, it was I've rarely had an experience like that, where, especially on those last 2 days, and I would say most especially in the last 24 hours where I did write straight for 24 hours and wrote about the last 35 pages of the script there. You know, after I turned that in and they had a chance to read it, there were changes, and over the next month or so we did rewrites and stuff, but those last 35 pages actually changed very little. And I was really surprised. It's one of those things where I'm sure there are other writers in here where every once in a while you just hit, Michael Jordan called it the zone. You know, every once in a while you just hit the zone and it's just everything is flowing, and I don't get that very often. I wish I could figure out a way to tap into it, get it more, but that's what it was. So anyway, we handed it over. We did several drafts after that, some polishes and rewrites, and brought actors in to read it, and then he was able to listen to it from there and hear dialogue that did work or didn't work. And then at that point, they went into production. My schedule was such that I couldn't be there every single day. In fact, I could only be there for a couple days right at the beginning. That's when Jeff and I first met, but then I was gone, and so that's when they had Jeff on the set to act as, well, I think he was really well suited, because I don't have a military background. My dad was a World War II veteran, is a World War II veteran, but that's about as far as it went for me. And so even to do the rewrite, I was cramming. You know, I had books all over the table and was trying to make it at least somewhat historically accurate. And again, that's one thing, we're having Jeff on the set, they were able to take that. Okay, now this is great storyline, but, you know, actually they would never say it this way, they would never do it this way. Let's take it and make it a little bit more historically accurate. So as far as I'll just comment briefly on the LDS angle that came when I was, as Jeff said, when I was brought into it, the character who is called Deacon now, I think he was called Deacon when I got it, or was it Bishop? I don't know.
I wasn't there telling me.
Yeah, okay. It went through, you know, several, while he was Bishop, and then it was Deacon, because that Bishop was just too much. And anyway, we went through that whole process of trying to decide. I had my first draft that I put back. He was from Levan, Utah, and identified himself as a Mormon, or at least they talked about it. He's a Mormon from, you know, from Utah. But this all was evolving, is how specific do we want to be with it? They actually shot the scene where he says where he's from two different ways. In one take it was from Levan, Utah, and another take it was from Snowflake, Arizona. And ended up going with Snowflake, and I have to be honest, at the time I was pushing back against this. As the direction was going to pull out references, specific references to the LDS Church, as an LDS screenwriter, you know, I felt like, gosh, why can't we? Just, you know, this isn't a Mormon movie, but you know what? One of the characters is a Mormon. Why can't we say that? You know, what's wrong with saying that? Or I guess it was more so, why do we have to avoid saying it? In retrospect, looking back on it, I think at the stage where we are right now in films that are made in Utah, I think it does for some reason help with acceptability to get it out there. So anyway, there were a lot of decisions that were made just before we started shooting to, you know, how we were going to approach this character, and then even while we were shooting, it went in a direction, and even again, as I mentioned, in the editing room, it went in a direction. In fact, there were specific lines where the actors were brought in to kind of re-loop. It's called looping, or just bring in and re-give some dialogue, re-record some dialogue when they were off camera or shooting them from behind, kind of a thing, to even hone that a little bit. So it wasn't by chance. The way it's presented and the way the church is presented there was not, you know, was not a haphazard. It was very very specific. So I'll just leave it there, and then.
That's a good point.
So when you first wrote this, when I wrote the screenplay, when my story, I was given certain parameters, and he's covered the LDS angle. I'll just give you some movie stuff. It's a little off topic. I was told that we wanted to shoot it in the snow because our director was so gifted in the cinematographic contrast to that. And I'm trying to think what the other parameters were. I'll tell you what I remember in my experience was, as far as the LDS angle, my next door neighbor is a man named Willy Frank, and he was a German soldier in World War II, and he fought. He started very early, and he was fought through France, and he fought through the Russian front, and he fought in Yugoslavia, was eventually captured by the Soviets at the end of the war, and spent 5 years in a prison camp rebuilding Yugoslavia. And he was LDS, and his parents were early converts in Germany. And he was from the Hamburg region, and he... It was very unusual to find someone that much heritage. And I said, I have one question for you. Did you meet another German Mormon in all of World War II? And he says, not a single one. So that's where my angle came from, to meet, have these people in conflict on the battlefield. And so I'll just give you what I did on the set. I was asked to come down 3 days before the shoot started, and the actors were all there waiting for me in a rehearsal studio. And I got off the curb, and I was just telling him this story. When you hand in your script, you never know what you're going to see in the next draft. You really don't know. And even the name changes were going very fast at the last minute. And so this wonderful actor, Peter Holden, steps off the curb in Springville and says, "You're Jeff?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "I played Gunderson." And I had no idea what he was talking about. And he wanted to know all about his character. And you've got to fake it. You can't tell them the truth. So, because they have faith in you. They want to know their characters. They don't want to know that you have to. So we went in there and we rehearsed for 3 days. Now, they had all sorts of questions about their characters. They had all sorts of questions about what this was all about. They had deep questions, where the person came from. And so I had to do a quick study of what he had done, his magic, and remember what I had done. And then we actually went through military training in the Springville Art Museum. There's this annex over there where you can have art classes, and it's an old church. It rents for $25 a day. And I was marching these guys around in a circle, literally. I'm ex-Special Forces, okay, a long time ago. And I had them crawling. I had them learning. A couple of them knew how to shoot a rifle anyway. And all these things we kept talking about and transforming these guys, because these guys were real L.A. actors. And Corbin is an LDS, and Kirby Haywood is LDS. And I think Larry is too. So we had three of them, but we really didn't talk about that on the set. Because we felt it had been established what we were going to do there, and so we marched around and all that kind of stuff. And then they got so engrossed in it all. I was asked to go on the set for the first. Brian said, "Will you come on down? I have a lot of questions. We just don't know what we're going to be doing," because I was probably the only person on the set with any military experience. And because it was such a technically detailed film, I remember standing there, and Corbin had the wrong helmet on. He's a corporal, and he has two stripes right here. And they had his helmet on the wrong guy. And can you imagine shooting that whole film with that one little thing wrong, and no one would have known it? Ryan came up to me and he said, "Is that the right helmet?" And I was horrified. I said, "You didn't shoot any?" No. So those kind of things. And the snow, I just want to tell you, how many of you seen it yet? I hope you really liked it. No, ma'am, it's in the theaters.
No, I was thinking we were talking about
the last one. No, that one. No, I'm talking about Saints and Soldiers right now. Yes, it is available in video, and it plays often on KBYU, I think. So I want to tell you, so if you have any questions about the film, I'd feel more comfortable rather than just rambling on about it. Just raise your hand and ask about movies. We've had so much of that. It's really kind of a fun break. But it really was that cold. When you see the film, it's just, you see the breath, you see the tension, you see the people shivering. It really was that cold. And those actors really did endure it outside, sometimes up to, they had their own trailer which was one of the few places with its own private restroom. And so it was like a gold, made a gold, that little area for them. But they were often on the set for 12 hours a day, maybe longer. Sometimes they did long night shoots. We shot the whole thing in 30 days. We shot it for less than $1 million. And if you know anything about movies, 95% of it was shot handheld by the director himself. Now that's 95% of it was shot outdoors. So this is really something to do all this. But there was something about making this movie that I can tell you when it started when they had rolling for the first frame. Everybody felt there was something very unusual about this film. Okay, I don't know if it's supernatural, I don't know if it's natural, but there was only one day for, movies are very intense places, and people are in conflict, and they argue, and they're famous for their conflicts, and people fighting for their ideas, and some people being temperamental. There was one sour word in this during the whole shoot. And a grip had a weapon shot too close to his head, and he blurted out, the F-bomb and rocked off. And that was it. The rest of this time, everybody had this same vision of what this was going to be. We kept feeling this momentum growing in this thing. And then you're going to worry, weary, very, very weary, because it takes so much energy to concentrate on doing a motion picture. And Ryan is really the leader of the pack, and everybody looks to him for the answers. And he's an amazing young man. I say young man, he isn't to me. So on this film, you'd see, my life kind of came true in this film, because I'd spent, since 1977, researching World War II. I was very fortunate to go around. I had my money, my family was quite affluent, had money. And I began researching World War II and going over the battlefields with the veterans in 1977, 78, when it really wasn't cool in this culture to even talk about anything about military heritage. It was a very toxic culture to military history. And I got involved with a group called the U.S. Rangers. And I went to Normandy, and I got to one of the greatest thrills of my life was I wrote the inscriptions for President Reagan's plaques that he dedicated at Point du Hoc in Omaha Beach, and was a special guest there at that time, the 40th anniversary of D-Day. And so, but when you do these things, as Matt knows, when you're a writer, when you're a historian, when you're any kind of researcher, it's a lot of plotting alone, and a lot of lonely nights, and a lot of stacks of materials and concentration, and it's anything but exotic. And so to have all this culminate, so Saints and Soldiers is very meaningful to me as my life, because to have nearly 30 years of my life and culminate that into a project to create the authenticity just stuns me. And the fact that we're doing so well, and the fact that it has so much of my culture in it and so much of my heritage. So making a war movie is probably the hardest thing I've ever done, and making this war movie was extremely hard. So yes, sir.
I saw the movie. Yeah, I thought it was fantastic.
Thank
wonderful.
You.
I'm amazed that you could shoot such a amazing full-length movie in 30 days. I mean, how did you do that?
Well, very careful scheduling.
Also, if we could have you repeat the question.
Okay, oh yes. Yes, how difficult was it to make a film like this in 30 days? It was terribly difficult. And we didn't have that much money. And Adam Abel, who's a very faithful member of the church, he's our accountant producer, and he's literally watching the money burn. You're burning $15,000, $20,000 an hour at some points in the film, and you don't get to repeat that. Once that money's gone, you can't go back and somehow use it again. And so in particular, the battle scenes are very difficult, because we had, just so you know what happened, why this film, why this thing is so blessed, whatever you want blessed to mean. We had reenactors come to this film on their own dime to be in it, and brought their own uniforms, their own weapons, all on the promise they'd get to shoot off all the blank ammunition they could possibly shoot off. Okay? Because these reenactors are real. And we had two, now let's get this, we had two guys that had been fighting in Afghanistan, active duty army guys, and they flew off, and they got on leave. I mean, they were done fighting in Afghanistan, and we were just going into Iraq at that time. And these guys show up, and they're in full German garb, the sniper veils and everything. And they'd come to be in the movie, and they'd just been fighting in Afghanistan. It just shocked us. And we so what, 150, approximately 150 of those guys, both American and German, come in and shoot the film because they heard through some of these people that this was really going to be the authentic war film they always wanted to see. And so all these things came into confluence. And even the snow, we were really worried about snow. It was a real drought year. And too much snow is bad, too little snow is even worse. And so for the battle, I was going to tell you about the battle scenes. So you have 150 guys out there, and you have weapons, and you have vehicles, and you have everybody waiting. We called it Big Week. And we were going to shoot all the major battle scenes in 3 days, because everyone could be there. And I made Ryan a little promise I could die twice in the film. I don't know why I felt that would be good. And so I got to die up front as an American soldier. And if you look real quick, I have captain's bars on. You can see me die very quickly. And then I can't tell you who. I actually kill one of the main characters. And then they kill me. I'm a German. Okay. It was great release. And you got to get... They have this explosive thing they put on your back. It's called a squib. And it's full of blood. And they run a wire up your leg. Then they touch two wires, and this thing explodes, you know, and throws you 3 or 4 feet. It was a great experience. So, anyway, just lots of movie lore about this thing. There was one day, I got to tell you guys, there was one day when we were shooting the Malmedy Massacre, it first came, and we needed snow. Oh, we needed snow, and it snowed just perfectly, just wonderfully, not too deep. And then you can't have any sunlight because the Battle of the Bulge is supposed to have air. Oh, you know about the Battle of the Bulge, just real quick. It's the largest land battle in United States history. Took place in the winter of 1944, Buxton, Belgium, where the Germans weren't supposed to attack, and they did. And they did it under the cover of the worst storm in, I think, a century. Okay, so we're trying to duplicate the storm. And there's sunshine everywhere. But sure enough, I don't want to put anything supernatural in this. Things would fog up and the sun would disappear. Not always. You'll see a few incongruent shots in the film. But the day of the Malmedy Massacre, this wonderful, wonderful waist-high mist just rolled in. Right, just perfect. And nobody could believe, and it covered the lights and everything. And all you could see was the World War II stuff and the people waiting around. And it was spooky. It was so real. And everybody's just looks perfect, and you have, almost like you're little photograph of back time travel, and so you had all this going on. And by the way, in case you want to know how we take care of things when the Lord doesn't let it snow, we use Betty Crocker potato flakes, and we used $15,000 worth of Betty Crocker potato flakes, and they just bring it in by truckloads, and oh, it's just amazing. So anyway, this film is magical. Truly, it is blessed. There were so many obstacles to making this film from soup to nuts, from the very beginning. And from when I was asked to write my little seminal thing in a top stop at Thanksgiving Point with Ryan Little, and we ate a bagel together, to the premiere of the film last week, which was just stupendous, thanks to Excel. It's just amazing. Making the money, by the way, he told you I have money. They tried for a year to make, 6 months to raise that money. And Ryan went all over the country. He went everywhere trying to find less than $1 million for this film. And we were talking about it, and we were very let down because we were getting in November. The drop dead date was like November 18th, something like that. And we were beginning to psychologically prepare to wait a full year before we could get into the winter window again, because we needed 5 weeks of preparation to do a war movie. Okay, so at 5 o'clock on the drop dead date, Ryan calls me, Jeff, we got the money. Well, we couldn't believe it. And then we're the dog that caught the bus. We got to prepare for a movie in 5 weeks, a war movie with tanks and airplanes and everything on Earth. And that huge, huge obstacle of getting that all together. But I think it really worked because everybody was so frenetic and working so hard, it was a blur. And I remember, just so you know how exotic Hollywood is, I hadn't ever been paid. Mine was an act of faith in Ryan, and Ryan's was an act of faith in me. I was so flattered that he would ask me to write a movie. I said, sure, and I wouldn't get paid. So he said, Jeff, come on down. And we did some things with the contract. I sent it to an attorney. And I ran down to Orem, this is Hollywood, into this kind of not so nice residential area. And we're at this warehouse that Ray owns, full of military equipment that he owns, he's been using for the movie, and there are 30 guys down there pulling stuff out, saying, we'll use this, we'll use that. And I show up, and it's a producer. I show up, and the producer's standing there, and he says, oh, yay, Jeff's here. And everybody says, yay, for about 2 minutes, or 2 seconds, and they turn back to their job. And he comes over and says, oh, we've got to pay you. So he pulls out a ledger checkbook. We go over the hood of a truck. Okay, and check 001, they pay me. Okay, I'm standing in the middle of the street of an Orem with this check, which I won't tell you how much it was. I'm sorry. And they all said, sorry, we don't have time to talk now. And they rush off and think, wow, this is Hollywood. This is movie making. And so, obstacle after obstacle occurred making this film. And they all, and even... if things were Excel was facing, and things we were facing throughout the whole, everything we've overcome with huge success, and then when we started winning all these awards, it just was baffling because it got to be a joke. We'd get a call from Ryan, we won first place again, again and again and again. And so after all this, and by the way, just so you know, we don't get a lot of people that outside the state that recognize it as LDS influence. We had at Marco Island, Florida, we had a, which was one of the biggest in the United States, and we won first place. And some Baptists came up to Ryan afterwards, Baptists, and you know how they feel about Mormons, and they hadn't caught a whiff of it. This is the best film we've ever seen. This is wonderful. It's so wonderful how you portray Baptists. And Ryan and Adam, of course we did. So what I'm especially proud of, and I'm going to stop after this, and then you can ask Matt some more questions, you can raise your hand, is that we created a film that, yes, we live this culture, see some very clear signs that Deacon is an LDS person. But we also created a film that other faithful people can really latch on to and see their faith into it and see their kind of meaning in this film. And so we have actually created, and this is what we should really be proud of, our culture, our state, our people, our energy, our creativity, created something that's universally accepted, I think, throughout the world. By the way, one question on the world. We've been selling overseas. We're having marvelous results in Europe selling our film. And I think France and Germany and all that. And Norway picked it up for twice the amount they paid for the Fast and the Furious Part 2. So we know we're beating them all. So, all right, I'll stop now. And, yes?
You actually go back to my last comment. I mean, I don't see why this is something to be proud of. You've created a film that insiders can look at and say, oh, yes, LDS cinema, look how successful we're being. But the rest of the world doesn't see this
out there.
That almost seems kind of
slow. Well, it's not a missionary program. It never was. I never sat down and wrote it like that. I wrote a strong LDS character in it because the producer wanted it to. We really never thought of anything devious one way or another. What we were trying to do is create a film that simply stated certain human values. And rather than saying you can only get it through this kind of faith or you can't get it through that kind of faith, we just applied what we knew best. So we weren't, there's no deceit at all in this film. No sleight of hand. Yes, sir?
Target audience necessarily.
Okay, the question is there any real target audience? It changed, didn't it, Matt?
By the time I got it, the hold of the script, the target audience was a general audience. Let's see, this has got to get outside of Utah. you know, in Southern California and Arizona. This is a story that's more important than that. And so, yeah, the audience was America, and, you know, again, hopefully internationally as well.
How true did you say to the original true story?
If you see the trailer, it says based on actual events. Quite frankly, I think that's a loose interpretation. It was based on a certain actual events that were brought together. Obviously, Malmedy massacre happened. Okay, there were men who escaped from there and had to go off into hiding. There were men who feigned death, as the other soldiers were being shot, and then got up and ran off. Those things happened. We took those characters, and then created fictional characters from that. There are a number of scenes in the film that were based on actual events from people that Jeff and I had interviewed. If you haven't seen it, I won't tell you, but there are a number of them that we just kind of pulled together and said, these are great stories, let's take them and give them to these characters. And throughout the film, that a group of guys who actually went through the story that we tell, as far as I know, didn't actually happen.
No.
All together.
There are no paratroopers at Malmedy. Okay? Two of the characters are paratroopers. Malmedy really did have one thing that happens that's strange when you write these kind of things based on, you write something fictional and then you come up and people multiply come up and say, yeah, this is exactly what happened. And let me tell you what, for example, hiding under the bodies, one of our characters hides under dead bodies. And it's the 285th Field Artillery Observation Battalion that was killed at Malmedy. And I get a call, and there's an article in the Deseret News about when we finished the film. And I get a call from a reporter who's got somebody on the line, and it's this woman, and he says, my father was there, and he's the one that hid under the bodies, and he lives in St. George. And he's one of three guys that survived. And he lives in St. George. Now, it was so horrific to him, he wouldn't talk about it to us, and we respected that. But honestly, Matt and I had that experience again and again and again. We'd write something that seemed, we tried not to make it fanciful, but, you know, very profound and shocking sometimes. And they would come up and say, yes, this really did happen to me. First person. Right.
Can you tell us about the rating system on that
board?
Sure. I have to preface this by saying, I am LDS, and I do not see rated R films, which is sometimes difficult as a filmmaker. After we wrote this, and then there were plans to release it at a certain time, but it kept getting delayed and postponed, and finally I called the producer, Adam, on the phone. It's, what's going on? He said, okay, well, a little secret, don't tell anybody, but we got an R rating. And so and they tried to decide what to, obviously the news got out. I think some of you, I'm sure, heard that initially got an R rating. I'm not going to go into my personal views on the MPAA and the rating system, but they were able to, they decided eventually that, because Adam Abel, the producer, doesn't see R-rated films either. So we had these little comments, are we going to see our movie? And I can tell you, I got razzed a lot. Oh, you won't see them, but you'll write them, I see. But we, eventually they, and I know that they went back a number of times to appeal that rating, and finally had to just make a few changes. There were a couple, bloody scenes. The interesting thing is that I was a little perturbed because, and I had not seen the film yet when it received its rating. I had only seen some preliminary rough cuts. And so I was a little perturbed the fact that I knew that they said, well, this scene is giving it its all, and this scene, these two scenes here, where both of them were scenes where it was a soldier trying to save another soldier's life, a soldier who'd been injured, and he was doing, the scene where they're trying to get a bullet out of a leg using the only instrument he had, which was a knife. And it got a little bloody. That scene is still there, but has been, some key little shots of it have been changed out. Another one, similar situation where a soldier is dying and another soldier is trying to save him. They get bloody. So, I was actually a little perturbed by that. I do have to say, in all honesty, when I finally saw the film, there were a couple moments, even I had actually, there were a couple. What it was. Yes.
I saw the film. Loved it.
Thanks. Thank you.
Obviously, again, I have two questions. Is it playing nationwide?
Yes, in a ripple effect. Okay.
My other question is, I assume this is fictional of the I hate to give this too much away.
Yeah.
Running into LDS people running into each other. Have you run into people?
Sure, we can't stop running into them. Honestly,
comment on that again without going into too specific. But that experience of an LDS soldier running into a German soldier that was LDS that he knew happened. A guy that I interviewed, and then and also the events that went into how they met and all that. I actually had to tone that down a little bit because the true story was so astounding. Yeah, and that's the interesting comment I've got, and we actually toned down the true story.
People keep coming to us and saying, this happened to me, or soldiers that were Mormon on the same side keep running into each other. Yes, sir.
Really quick, as far as the release goes, right now it's only playing in Utah, and we already have it booked in several other cities starting in September, and then it all depends on how well it does to go into a nationwide rollout, but that's planned for sometime in October. So,
yes, sir.
I haven't seen it yet.
All right.
I see it. Everybody's told me how great it is.
I like that.
I've noticed your campaign is based on your success in film festivals.
Yes.
And you use that as a strong part of your campaign.
Yes.
How effective has that been? I mean,
boy,
does the public? Do they care about, film festival awards and things like that?
I was a film critic. I'd like to talk about a little bit about my past. I was a film critic on Fox television and radio for about 4 years. And I can tell you it's very effective to see this pedigree, especially an independent film and especially a war film and an independent war film. Somehow it all comes together and just really has helped so tremendously.
I'll add a comment on that too. Sorry, really quick. One thing that the filmmakers are really proud of too, the producer and the director, is that they get excited about all the Best Picture awards they win, but about half of them are grand jury prize, and the other half are all audience choice. And so, from an artistic standpoint, they love the grand jury prizes, but from a potential box office success standpoint, they love the audience choice awards, and those are the ones that tend to tell you, like up at Sundance Film Festival, it's the audience choice winners that end up being your Blair Witch Project or Whale Rider, the ones that go on to have kind of a widespread mainstream appeal, and they've received a lot of those, so those have been helpful.
Where are the mountains
with
the film?
Alpine, Utah. It was filmed in Midway. If you go to Midway, there's this little orchard farm that's a state park. We shot there. We shot at the state mental hospital. There's this castle thing on the hill that was built during the Depression, and it was never finished, and that's where we shot all the scenes that take place in castle-like things. And then the old mill in Salt Lake City. We shot some of the final battle scenes there, and I think we had a few pickup shots here and there, but it was mainly those four areas. Yeah. Yes, sir.
You talked about the difficulty of getting a funding came in the last minute. Can you talk about that further?
I wasn't in on it. All of that was through the pipeline, because that was really Adam Abel and the director going out and beating their hands bloody on doors. And everybody, do you have something?
Just a little there is that I know that they did have a funder fairly early on who said, I'll put up half. and then the struggle was to find the other half. And so they really kept working, and they kept kind of trying to nurture this funder along, keeping him happy. You know, you're still going to give your half, still going to give your half as soon as we, I'll give it as soon as you have the rest, kind of a thing. And then it was finally a matter of when it came down to it, I remember staying up real late one night with Ryan and writing up basically a synopsis of this is the story. By the way, he had committed half just on faith. He hadn't seen a script, or anything like that. He'd committed half on the fact that Ryan had done a little, short student film called The Last Good War that he really liked, and he wanted to, to make something great. But it was Ryan and I sitting up late and putting together a little synopsis, which we sent to him, and then they asked him, how about all of it? And a lot of back and forth, and like Jeff said, just right at the last, literally the last hour, they finally came through and said, okay, we'll do it all. Which, by the way, they're very happy that they did that. I believe that the international rights that were sold before the film even released more than made their money back for them. And so,
well, that's one thing I'd want to say. We had a question about why. Really, when it came down, and I hate to bring it all back to this, we're capitalists, and we wanted to make a money-making film, and that was one of the things we kept thinking, will we make the investors' money back? And that, and Ryan and Adam were so dedicated to that one notion, so. Yeah.
Can I just follow up with that? Sorry for asking so many questions.
No.
Does the investor then get points on the movie and that kind of thing? It was all set up beforehand. How that would work?
Yes.
So the investor must be very happy.
Yeah, from what I hear, yeah, they're smiling.
Okay.
Literally.
It would help on the tape if you repeat those questions.
Okay.
Okay.
The question being, is the investor involved in getting point, what they call points or a percentage of the profits? And yes, I couldn't tell you specifically on what those are, but I know that they are getting their points and they are happy with it. And I know I've spoken to the same filmmakers and said, hey, let's do it again. Let's do something else. So, yeah.
Matt, you said that they cut LDS references.
Good question. I'm trying to think specifically. The question was that there was a decision to cut some specific LDS references from the film. What were some of those? The best that I can remember, they were some of these. One was, as I mentioned earlier, instead of making them from Utah, let's make them somewhere else, from somewhere else. And so I did go through this process. And again, I remember your question earlier. I didn't see it as being deceptive, but I thought, you know what? I know this guy is LDS, and if we're not going to put it out there, but where else would people that are LDS be from? Well, Snowflake, Arizona. And again, anybody else watching that's probably not going to pick up on it, but it's a little, maybe a little smile moment for somebody from, from Snowflake or from somebody from Utah who's going to know that. So where he was from was one of them. Specifically mentioning that he was Mormon. When they're asking each other, tell me about this deacon guy, and initially in the script he said he is a Mormon from Utah, squarest guy I ever met. That was changed just to one of the squarest guys I ever met, doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, doesn't even like coffee. They did that.
Even the word like,
doesn't drink. Doesn't drink coffee. They said doesn't like coffee. There were, some very, very specific things. Some that I agree with. Some that I don't necessarily. I mentioned that earlier. That I have no problem having an LDS character be an LDS character, and everybody knows it. And hopefully investors will get to the point where they're comfortable with that, and I think there are two reasons why they may be wary. One is because there's a history. The church is known for being a missionary based church, and so there's this thing. Anything that has a Mormon, they're trying to proselytize to me. I don't even think what the other reason was. I had two reasons when I went into this. That's all I can think of right now. But another thing that was changed. It wasn't so much a change, but when I wrote the script, his little book that he had was his military edition of the Book of Mormon, and even as I wrote it, though, we'd kind of decided early on that we wouldn't specifically say, this is your book, your Book of Mormon. He would just refer to it as your little book that you're reading or something, and again, let people read into that what they will.
But that was another one of the changes that was made. Agree with it or not? You know, I don't know. Could have gone either way, and I quite frankly think the film is just as good. You know, I don't know if it makes it better, but just as good having those references specifically in. But the decision was made not to.
On that subject, the obvious reference is one of the things that they have the character say is that his partner there says that he didn't kiss his wife until they were married. How common is that, even in the church?
You know, I had a friend that. So the question was like the question of the line where he says, "I didn't kiss my wife till I was married." How common is that in the church? Not very common, I'm sure. It wasn't my case, I can guarantee you. But I had a friend that actually several of them, but one in particular that I was thinking of when I wrote that line. Here's an interesting thing from a guy who maybe somebody wouldn't share with his buddies, because the context of that scene was they're sharing things that they wouldn't share with guys normally. And that's the first time the deacon kind of comes out of his shell and says something that surprises everybody. And it does happen, albeit rarely.
What kind of connection or relationship or colleaguehood or whatever do you have with Richard Dutcher?
Not much at all. I mean, we know each other, and I would love to work with Richard on a project. My personal opinion, I think Richard is a very good filmmaker, very good storyteller, and I'm anxious to see what he does in the future. I think that his for me personally, watching God's Army, which we all know, kind of opened up this what has been referred to as LDS cinema, and even a reason to talk about it, but I was, again, low budget, not perfect, but a story and characters that I cared about. And so Richard and I see each other at lunch, occasionally we'll pass and say hi, but don't know him real well. Yeah.
What I liked about the film is that it was overtly LDS, and we had the LDS character, but the other characters of the film also do heroic things and make sacrifices, while the LDS character sometimes struggles. The other characters, if you could talk about the other three other people that you decided, why you decided to pick where they're from, and I kind of felt a little bit that the gentleman from New York City was kind of a little bit stereotyped. Could you talk about how you decided to write those characters?
Because Gould was really mine.
Yeah.
There was one character in there named Gould, and the question was to talk about the other characters, and in particular the character from New York. Actually, he's from Brooklyn. Brooklyn Heights, as he says in this wonderful piece. And he's a very interesting character. He's my favorite one because he's so dark. And he is, I can't give away too much, but I think he breaks the stereotype of the typical medic. Maybe not the typical guy from New York, but Musi the medic is a, the guy everybody trusts. He's kind of the godfather, uncle, the one with the big heart and the one that cares. He is not that kind of character. Gunderson was originally named Danny Epstein, and he was his best friend. He was Jewish. I had that experience when I was in the Army, being LDS background. My best friend was Jew, and my grandfather's Jewish, so it's kind of mixed. And one thing I want to say about, let him take over. Deacon, as I remember, I wrote him. I've known some LDS guys, like tremendous warriors in World War II. Tough, mean when they had to be, which breaks the stereotype of the LDS person. And I wanted to make him a really hard-nosed killer when he had to be. And he just had seen too much, and he was nearly catatonic the way I wrote him. We really toned that down. I mean, he really didn't know who he was or where he is or the way the original movie was, and he had all this conflict in his head over who he was and how good he was. And so the film was, he has to regain his sanity in order to kill and survive. And that great contradiction, that is the experience of war. And so again, I wanted to show LDS, that character, when he was highly identified as LDS, as really a very tough, tough guy in war. So,
I just have a question about the writing. I'm a few minutes late, and you may have explained this. Why don't you do first draft and the other do the second draft then?
That's correct. So the question was in the writing.
process. Did one do first draft, one second draft? Yes. Jeff wrote the first draft, and I was brought in to write the second draft.
How did that work? I mean, it seems like I'm a writer myself. It seemed like that would be very difficult.
No.
Again, we did not meet until day three of shooting. So there was never any physical collaboration on that, which is by the way extremely common. In fact, usually happens this way with screenplays in the film industry. I don't always agree with the way it works, but that's the way it works right now. Is very often they'll hire a writer, they'll get a draft that they like, and then for some reason they'll hire another writer to get a fresh take at it and do a different take on it. Happens all the time.
Not even a phone call. Did we ever speak?
Yeah.
How did you like the second draft?
We were talking about that yesterday. Having written the first draft,
how did you respond to the second draft?
I was shocked. Yeah. I mean, you invest all this time, and then you look at it, and you just say, this is the experience. You leave your ego at the door, and you just say, there are wiser people than I in this world, and we're here to make a collaborative process. It's so organic. And you look at it and you say, okay, I catch on and all that. It is hard, but you have to have faith in the whole process.
I would just add to that. Once we turn it over, it continues to evolve and to change. There are lines, one of my favorite lines in the film, I didn't write. Actually, when I saw it, I thought, wow, that was good. And I went back to the script and, oh, I didn't write that. I was the actors on the set thinking, you know what, this is, what if we did this? And a director said, yeah, let's go with that. Several of those where I just thought they made it better. Again, being in the environment and taking it. So it's an evolutionary process. And usually, it doesn't always work to the benefit of the piece. You know, you see a lot of films out there that are awful, and a lot of that's because they go into what's called development hell, where they just bring writer after writer, and eventually it just loses whatever they were interested in the first place. It loses that, whereas this one is able to preserve that, and I think, you know, it just kept getting better and better to where it is.
Yeah. And then one comment about the collaborative process. It was mentioned earlier when Jeff came back and looked at when Peter Holden, one of the actors, came up and asked about his character Gunderson, and Jeff had no idea who he was talking about. That's just another example of how it develops, that once the actors got there and read the script, they asked permission to add some personal touches to their characters. And what the actor Peter Holden did is he changed his character to his grandfather was named Gordon Gunderson and actually fought in the Battle of the Bulge and was awarded, you know, I think he had a Purple Heart and so he asked the director if he could basically, in essence, play his grandfather in the movie. And so that was something that was added after the whole screenwriting process happened.
One more thing about that. I have never told Matt this story. It would horrify him. When I went to train the actors, and which mainly tells me, keep low. That's how you tell. If you want to be a Civil War film, everybody's nearly on the ground all the time. When I walked in, the actors had been discarding script. Well, we don't want to say that, and that's too long. And they're just tearing it to pieces. And so, oh, goodness gracious. So, believe me, from the first moment it happened, your guts are torn out of you.
it's very, very different from a playwright than a playwright. Being a screenwriter is extremely different than being a playwright. Playwright, once they write those words, they are sacred. And legally, the actors or the director cannot change those without his specific permission. A screenwriter doesn't carry quite that weight influence. And it does, I mean, that what he just described, I know, that's what happens. And hopefully, in this case, we had good actors who were committed to the heart of the story, and so it just made it better, I think. Yeah.
I think you said that,
Yes.
And rich.
Yes, I know the question.
No,
good.
The
smoking.
Yeah.
And obviously Kirby would be the best one to answer that question, but they're herbal cigarettes, for what it matters, which is used in the industry for people who do not smoke tobacco. They have these herbal cigarettes that they can use for that, which are not addictive and not nicotine and not tobacco. But obviously Kirby made a decision, you know, that with his character he would do that. I couldn't answer that.
And just having spoken with all the actors and they're sharing their anecdotes, some of the other actors actually gave him a real cigarette at one point, and he just turned green. And so that's how they kept him honest.
I witnessed that, by the way.
Yes, sir.
At what
Excel get on board? Had you finished the film? And then there you distribute, right?
Yeah, I'm with Excel, by the way. It was after the film was completed, and we at Excel, we try to keep an eye, especially on this group of filmmakers that are all coming out of BYU. They have this great film program at BYU, and there's just all these talents coming out. The movie Napoleon Dynamite that was just released is also BYU, lots of BYU people involved in that. And so we keep in contact with the filmmakers, and Ryan Little and Adam Abel were two people, you know, we contacted, wanted to, you know, they need a distributor. It looked like it. Yeah, you also want to find a good fit. Like, is it a good fit for us as a distributor, and also for them as filmmakers? Could we do the kind of release they wanted? You know, where we knew it would play well regionally, so we could do that first and then roll it out wider. And that's how we. So we did come on board after it was complete. After it was complete.
Did you try to pre-sell it? You know, with clips of it. It was completely done by the time you got it.
Yeah, the question is, did we try to pre-sell it at all? And no, it was completely done when Excel came on board. Other questions? All right. Help.
You said that you pre-sold your international rights. Is there a planned international rollout? And was it sold to one distributor or a sales agent, or do you have Ryan and Lee?
The question is about international rights, and there are several other distributors in Europe, and they're planning their own releases. So we're not really.
I'm not aware of any of the quote LDS genre films that ever had any kind of international rollout.
Excel doesn't have any international rollout, so that's why we sold it to these smaller distributors that are overseas in some of these European countries, and they're basically in charge of their own rollout. So it went really great. We sold it in several countries for good amounts, and they sold the rights, and so they're just hoping for the best from all these audiences. It'll be interesting to get feedback from some of the places that it plays internationally. We don't really have that yet. Anything else? We'll do, I think, one or two more questions. We have time, but I just... Are the two screenwriters going to collaborate again? After that story about them shredding up the script on the set, I don't know.
No, I would be very honored to work with Matt again. I think I'll be honest with you. I don't want to do another war movie for a while. I just want to go look at daffodils and things. You know, too much war gets to be really fast, and it's a very hard topic. And I'm a much more social guy than that. So, but I would be honored to work with Matt.
And same here. I'm actually just finished a script on the Helmut Huebner story. I don't know, some of you may be familiar with the LDS boys who started their own resistance group in Nazi Germany. So I'm once again kind of in that, although it's not a war movie, it's set in wartime Germany. And I'm really looking forward to a romantic comedy that I'm going to do next, quite frankly. Yeah.
Do you have something to do with the documentary called When Truth Was Treason, or which should have been called When Truth Was Treason?
But became Truth and Conviction, yes. It sounds like you know a little bit of the history of that. Yes, I was producer and director of that, and so that's why I'm familiar with that story.
Our program says that Ryan Little is going to be here. Does anyone know why?
Yes. Ryan Little is actually quite the up-and-coming director right now, and he is away on a new film, which happened. It was he and I that had talked about. He was actually excited about. He was his idea to come do this panel, and then he got a directing job, and so he was going to be back today. He actually is going to be back, but unfortunately, due to some extra shooting, wasn't able to get back till late this evening, so he was unable to make it. So, apologies from Ryan Little.
Thank you.
Yes, well, thank you, Jeffrey Panos and Matt Whitaker.
Well, I'll tell you what, you can, if you ever need to,
We are going to keep them also on the website.